Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Neurological Disorder Podcast. I'm your host, Merdula Barthi. In this episode, I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Nottaker, who is a board-certified general neurologist and a board-certified headache specialist. We all get headache, but does having a headache physically alter your brain? Does following a vegan or vegetarian diet make you more prone to headache? Does consuming alcohol recreationally intensify your headache? And the question that most of us want answered, can we prevent headache? Dr. Nottaker addresses all of these questions and explains the science behind how numerous drugs and substances lead to headache. We also discuss the difference between a headache and a migraine, and he clarifies some common misconceptions about them both, like the misconception that you can sleep off a migraine. We also dive into the importance of prioritizing health and sleep and talk about the ways that Dr. Nottaker is able to do this in his busy life as a neurologist, and he shares useful tips on how to put both your physical and mental health first. Get ready to learn all about headache. As a disclaimer, we do mention the names of various drugs and substances, and this episode is not meant to influence anyone's choices. It is simply to explain how different substances can affect headache. Now, I'm so excited to welcome Dr. Nottaker. Hi, Dr. Nottaker. Welcome to the Neurological Disorder Podcast. I'm so excited to have you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So to start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what drew you to neurology, specifically headache?
Sure. You know, I was born in Mumbai, India, but I grew up in Toronto, as you can see right over there, the center of mass. And, you know, growing up in Toronto, I had a great experience, probably the greatest city in the world. Hence, I still rep Toronto, even though I'm not there right now. And, you know, I grew up with a diverse background. Multiculturalism was prominent and celebrated in Toronto. So I really did appreciate that. After finishing high school, went to the University of Western Ontario, which is now named Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. I did a bachelor's of medical sciences with an honor specialization in pharmacology. So I looked at the study of how drugs work, not the drugs themselves, but how they work. And I didn't know at that time if I truly wanted to do medicine just yet. You know, I had always had an interest, and you know, through my undergrad years, for 5 years, I actually volunteered at a palliative care center and a long-term rehabilitation center. I worked with patients who have had 6 months or less left to live. So, you know, it was quite the experience for me getting to meet people and really talk to them about end-of-life care and see what it's like for them, you know, when they're coming to terms with going to be dying soon. So that in itself was an eye-opening experience. And after I got a lot of that experience, you know, I was having an interest in medicine, didn't know for sure. So I pursued a master's in pharmacology from the University of Toronto. And then while I was in my master's, I still continued to volunteer with the palliative care center. And I realized, you know, this is really where I want to go. And so I always had an interest in primary care when I first started and when I was growing up, because, you know, I had a family doctor myself. I appreciated the care that he gave us and got me in touch with whoever else I needed to see. I also did appreciate, you know, palliative care as well. And a lot of the times when I was looking at the fellowships, it seemed like you could take the route of primary care to get into palliative care fellowship. So that's what my initial interest was. And then I applied broadly across North America. I ended up getting into University of Hawaii. So it's the John A. Burns School of Medicine in Honolulu, Hawaii. And that's actually one of the maps up here too. I believe that one. And you know, I spent my 4 years there, had great education, got to see a different community altogether. Even though Hawaii is part of the United States, it's a different culture. It's a different mindset. You know, it's like its own world. And I really appreciated that because it's a completely different style of medicine. And it's a very large sense of community. So everyone really tries to help each other. And while I was there, I learned very quickly, maybe primary care isn't for me. I just could not, you know, work with children in a medical setting. That's not to say that they're not great individuals, and I have tremendous respect for pediatricians. In my case, I just could not do it. You know, and sometimes people realize very quickly some fields are not for them. And going through my medical school career, I really learned that I enjoyed neurology. I enjoyed that puzzle. of trying to figure out what is going on and seeing if we could try to help people. Mm-hmm. So I applied for residency. I got into the Thomas Jefferson University neurology residency program, finished my 4 years. And while I was there, you know, initially I was part of that same ignorant group that talked about, oh, migraine is just a headache. I don't get why people are making such a big deal of it. It's really not that bad. But, you know, some of my best friends suffered from migraine and have migraine to this day. And, you know, Jefferson coincidentally has one of the world's best headache centers attached to it. So I was exposed to a field of several headache attendings and, you know, rotating in the headache unit as well as managing headache patients. And I learned that it's a very severe debilitating disease. And migraine isn't the only headache disorder. There are several. It's just the most common. So that's the one that's most talked about. And when I saw how debilitating it was, you know, it got to me. But what I did appreciate was if you could really help someone, their headache got better, their quality of life got better, they were able to function much better and, you know, be what their ideal version of themselves would be. Mm-hmm. That made a huge impact for me. And so that's why I decided to pursue the fellowship. I got in, graduated, and then I moved to Columbus, Ohio, where I've been an attending as a general neurologist and headache specialist ever since.
Oh, that's a great story about how you like discovered your path. And I think palliative care is a very eye-opening experience watching the patients sometimes coming to terms with them going to pass away. And then specifically, I volunteered at a hospice place and everyone had a neurological condition like Alzheimer's or dementia. And just like you knowing that they're about to pass away, but sometimes them not realizing it, I feel like it was a whole new perspective for me.
Exactly. And, you know, my patients when I volunteered weren't just those with progressive neurologic diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease. But these were even individuals with stage 4 cancer, you know, various individuals who were just older and they're, you know, they weren't swallowing as well or they weren't walking as well. So the harder part, I think, there was not just them accepting that they're going to die, but it might take several months and they're fully aware of it. Mm-hmm. And them coming to terms with that. I think that provided me with a different style of medicine than what most people may have experienced.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify some terminology, you talked about migraine and headache. Could you talk about the difference between the two?
Sure. So migraine is a headache disorder. So headache is what we use as an umbrella term to encompass pretty much everything that might be similar or having to do with some similar topic. So for example, you know, headache being the umbrella term, within that you have migraine, you have cluster headache, you have tension type headache, you have cervicogenic headache, you have, you know, the trigeminal autonomic cephalalgias. And from that, I mean, hemicrania continua, paroxysmal hemicrania, SUNGT, SUNA. So as you can see, there are several various conditions that are all different headache disorders. I think one thing to really understand is there's no such thing as a normal headache. The majority of the world does not suffer from a headache. So, you know, majority of the world does not understand how severe a headache can be or how debilitating a headache can be. You know, you might get a headache occasionally if you hit your head on something. Okay, sure. You know, that's a traumatic headache. Or, you know, some individuals, probably not your age, but those who are much older, they may get a headache after a hangover. That's actually a variant of migraine that you can get due to alcohol. You can get headache from using certain substances. You can get headache from high blood pressure. But at the same time, migraine is a disease. Cluster headache is a disease. Trigeminal neuralgia is a disease. So these are individual disease processes that lead to headache and headache symptoms. So I think it's very important to distinguish between the cause of the headache and just using the words headache and migraine interchangeably. They're actually not interchangeable. They're very different. And that's why it's important for us to provide that kind of education.
I didn't know there was such a broad range of types of headaches. Thank you for telling me about that. So yeah. According, like a tension headache is that if you're stressed?
So tension type headache doesn't have to be where you're stressed. It's formerly known as tension headache, but we now have changed it to tension type headache. Tension type headache is essentially a headache disorder where someone might describe a band around their head. So it's like as if you're wearing a headband or like what the athletes will wear just to avoid sweat dripping into their face. And it's a squeezing sensation. So it's squeezing their head. So it's a very specific type of headache disorder. attention type headache has a lot of features that can overlap with migraine. So as a result of it, a lot of times people who might be misdiagnosed as one or the other, but you know, the treatment is oddly similar in a lot of cases. So, you know, even if you are misdiagnosed as migraine or tension type headache, we might still use the same medications to try to treat both. Okay. Stress can be a trigger for both migraine and tension type headache, as well as even sometimes cluster headache. So, you know, when we say tension headache or tension type headache, it's not just, oh, it's a stress-induced headache. In reality, it itself is a headache disorder.
Okay. And a lot of people wonder that if you have a headache, there's actually physical damage going on inside your brain. Is that the case?
So there are complex neurobiological processes that are going on. So what I mean by that is, you know, there's changes in blood flow, there's changes in inflammation, there's changes in the way the electrical signals in your brain are firing. But there is no permanent long-lasting damage that happens as a result of a headache disorder. What I will say is that migraine may lead to what we call white matter disease. So I don't know how familiar you are with the brain or how familiar your audience might be, but the outer part of your brain is called the gray matter. That's the part that allows you to be who you are. That's your higher level consciousness. So your ability to think, talk, interview me, you know, understand what you see in the world around you, you know, your design choices of your room, things like that. The deeper structures of your brain are called the white matter. Think of that as the information highway. So that's the part that sends all the signals throughout the brain. The white matter is what's affected within something like multiple sclerosis, for example. So migraine can lead to white matter lesions, but what we've found is that even though those lesions are there, they're not leading to any permanent damage.
Okay. That's good to hear. Might be relieving for a lot of people.
Yes.
So for the next section of this podcast, I'm going to list various substances. Could you talk about how that affects the brain and maybe like the neurobiology behind it?
Sure.
So starting with caffeine, specifically energy drinks. I don't know if you've heard of Celsius, but it's an energy drink going around. It has 200 milligrams of caffeine. I always tell people, like, why are you drinking it? It's two Celsius is like above the daily intake for caffeine. But some of my friends drank a Celsius every day for finals week and stuff. And after they stopped, they went into withdrawal-like symptoms. They had headaches every day and they just couldn't like get out of their room. So could you explain the neuroscience behind that?
Sure. So caffeine itself is a stimulant, right? A typical cup of coffee has about 65 milligrams of caffeine, if not a little bit less. I think a can of Coke might have a little bit more than that. But any of these energy drinks that are out there, you're actually drinking more than just a single cup of coffee a day, right? And it's all in one can. And, you know, kids these days will chug them. So you're getting a huge blast of caffeine all at once. When things that are stimulants, what they do is they help release a molecule called glutamate. Glutamate is a transmitter in the brain that helps create excitation. So it gets the brain wired up. And so you've heard of the fight or flight response when you're scared, you know, you either get ready to fight or you run. And that's what we call your sympathetic nervous system. Your sympathetic nervous system goes into overdrive with too much caffeine. And that forces people to be awake, you're alert, your pupils are dilated, you know, you're ready, you have more energy. You know, I've seen some people post online of how they started mowing their lawn because all of a sudden they have all this energy, or if they're really tired, all of a sudden they can focus. But what happens is your body becomes dependent on this caffeine, especially if your finals week or 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time, and you're taking such a high dose all at once. It's a temporary fix, but it's not addressing the underlying issue. So what happens is as your body got used to it, the minute you stop, it's an abrupt stopping of everything. So what's going to happen is your brain is craving that caffeine, so it's going to starve and it's going to try to stimulate itself, but there's nothing promoting it. And that's what can lead to the headache itself.
Okay. So next is alcohol, specifically consuming alcohol in like a recreational context.
Okay. So, you know, we have to define what is recreational because that's different for everybody. For some people, that's, you know, a simple glass of wine with dinner at night. It can go all the way to, you know, they're out with their friends at a bar doing six shots of vodka, tequila, rum, pretty much like six nights a week. So there's that whole spectrum that you have to think about when you use the term recreationally. So, you know, a better way to define it might be when it's not in a medical setting. So, you know, it's in a social setting or even just at home. Alcohol itself is what we call a GABA agonist. So GABA is known as a depressant. right? So it's what will help keep people calm. So it activates the parasympathetic nervous system. So the opposite. So by doing that, you know, people tend to get calmer. So you, I don't know if you've seen that, but they tend to get looser. They're less inhibited, meaning they're more vocal and they're more likely to share their opinions, even if it's not wanted or not something that they would want to say. People tend to develop a little more courage because their fears and their anxieties are no longer as obvious and not coming to the forefront. Mm-hmm. Alcohol itself, though, what it does is by activating all of these parts of the brain, it actually affects the cerebellum first, because there's a lot of alcohol-related receptors in the cerebellum. And as a result of that, that's what gets people to be wobbly. They have their slurred speech. They may have difficulty with vision. And if you drink too much alcohol, it's actually neurotoxic for the brain. It can lead to swelling of the brain. It can destroy tissue in the brain. And that's why some people can die from overdosing on alcohol. It can help suppress breathing. So as a result of that, if you don't breathe, you don't get oxygen, you can die from that. You know, in long-term, alcohol use can cause permanent liver damage, which then puts you at high risk for death. It can lead to stomach ulcers, intestinal ulcers, and bleeding. So, you know, it itself has a lot of negative effects. The other thing is alcohol is what we call a diuretic, meaning it makes you want to pee. Mm-hmm. So even though you think you're drinking something, you're actually peeing out all the water that's in your body. And so part of why we think it contributes to the variant of migraine the next day is that you're severely dehydrated if you drink too much. And that's what leads to people having a hangover.
Okay. And will you get like these same effects if you just don't drink water in a day? And will you like get a headache the next day? Is it the same type of dehydration?
It's slightly different because it's not just alcohol-induced dehydration. It's the alcohol molecule itself that's also affecting the brain.
Okay.
Right? So especially if you drink too much. If you don't drink enough water, it's not even that you may not get a, you may get a headache the next day. You might even get a headache that day. So staying hydrated is extremely important for our patients, especially in the summer or if you live in warm climates.
Yeah, I actually didn't realize that until recently. I used to go entire school days without drinking water. So I always had a headache after school, but makes a lot.
Oh, no, make sure you drink water. It's to the point where I keep one literally right next to my desk.
Okay, so the next substance is marijuana. Could you talk about some of the benefits, especially the medical marijuana, and then how it contributes to headache?
Sure. So marijuana, you know, it's a famous plant. It's been around for thousands of years. It's actually described within the South Asian culture. I don't know if you've heard of the term ganja, but ganja is Sanskrit for marijuana. And Sanskrit is the world's oldest written language. So, you know, it's obviously been there for thousands of years. It was used all over the world. You know, after Asia was invaded by different European countries, it then slowly spread all throughout the world. Weed itself, there's two main components that we tend to focus on. There's obviously many molecules involved with a marijuana plant, but we tend to focus on what we call THC and CBD. So THC stands for like tetrahydrocannabinoid. That's the part that gets people high. That's the euphoria that they experience. You know, you've seen the stereotype of someone eating a flaming bag of Cheetos or a hot Cheetos, and they're just sitting there going, like, yo, bro. So that kind of deal. That's the THC part. The CBD, which is cannabinoid, that's the part that actually helps with healing. It's the appetite stimulant. It's the part that can help with pain control as well as, you know, just keeping people calm. So it can help with anxiety. So lately, what we've been doing with medical marijuana is we're increasing the amount of CBD that's in the plant and lowering the THC. So you're theoretically helping the medical benefits from the plant and you're reducing the psychotropic effects, meaning the part that gets you high.
Okay.
You know, we've found that marijuana helped initially with cancer patients because it helped improve their appetite. It reduced a lot of their pain. Then it went into glaucoma, right, where it did the same thing. And so slowly, slowly, they realized that there's a benefit for many disease processes. In terms of headache, medical marijuana is a pretty good pain suppressant. So you can use it occasionally for headache management because it activates the cannabinoid receptors, which help reduce pain. The important thing to know, though, is there are studies coming out that show too much marijuana use may actually lead to something called medication overuse headache. It's also known as rebound headache or medication adaptive headache.
So does increasing the CBD content reduce like the addictive properties of the marijuana itself?
Yeah. And, you know, there's also studies that are showing that marijuana itself may not lead to addiction.
Okay.
Right. So when we think of addiction, it's people have a craving for that substance. And if they don't have it, you know, their body is literally craving it. Their mind focuses on it. So it's the same thing with caffeine. Caffeine can cause addiction. Chocolate has addiction. You know, many hard substances can have addiction. Weed itself doesn't tend to cause addiction. If you see people saying like, oh, I need the weed. It's not the addiction itself. It's maybe that the weed is helping some underlying anxiety or something else that's going on that makes them want to use it in order to keep themselves calm.
Okay. Yeah. So for the next substance, hallucinogens, could you describe what they are and what they do to the brain and then how they contribute to headache?
Sure. So hallucinogens are just any substances that alter the mind and someone's perception of reality. So, you know, there are very common ones. So, you know, you think of psilocybin, it's known as magic mushrooms. You can think of PCP, LSD. So I don't know if you knew, but the one who wrote Alice in Wonderland, there's always rumors that he was using LSD. And that's what led to like the Cheshire Cat and the weird designs that were in the book. Then, you know, you have K2, you have bath salts, spice. And I don't know if you're familiar, but bath salts and spice were made famous in Florida. Of all places. And so, you know, you have all of these substances that literally what their job is to alter your sense of reality and your perception. Don't forget peyote and ayahuasca, which have been more prominent lately, but they're indigenous to Latin America, Central South America, essentially, and even North America. And it was used in various indigenous tribes for religious purposes. So, you know, outside of altering the sense of reality, people tend to also be calmer. And if anyone has had depression, things like peyote and ayahuasca are being used to get someone into not just a state of nirvana, but a sense of enlightenment. You know, someone has discovered something about themselves and they've had an epiphany and they're finding that it's helping with the depression. And you can even think of another drug that's famous lately is ketamine. Ketamine itself is a hallucinogen. It gives you a sense of you're disconnected from your body. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and we're finding medical use for it too. It's been approved for treatment refractory depression. It's very useful in chronic pain syndromes. And it's actually been shown to be helpful in refractory headache as well.
Mm-hmm. And about your comment for Alice in Wonderland, I actually just talked to a patient. She has Alice in Wonderland syndrome, which, oh. Yeah. And just a quick recap for the followers, it's like you lose perception of reality, your arm becomes bigger than the other arm, and it's associated with migraines. So, yeah, I was looking at how the creator of Alice in Wonderland, people think that he might have had that condition, which is associated with migraine. In that case, like, does hallucinogens cause the same effects as someone with Alice in Wonderland syndrome?
It's dependent on the hallucinogen that you take.
Okay.
Right. So something like magic mushrooms, it can cause people to have an altered sense of reality in the terms of, yeah, one arm might look bigger than the other. You know, their visual spatial arrangement is gone. So they may think something is closer than it really is or something is farther than it really is. Mm-hmm. In reality, though, you know, the psilocybin, which is the molecule that's from magic mushrooms that gets people altered, small doses of it doesn't tend to alter their minds in any way. And they're doing studies currently where they're doing microdosing of psilocybin for treatment of cluster headache. And they're finding initial studies are showing a positive benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other substances like ketamine, you know, peyote, ayahuasca. Yeah, it can cause people to feel like one arm might be bigger than the other. But more importantly, these make you feel like you're not attached to your body. So have you heard of the term like astral projection, as if you're outside your body or your soul is outside your body looking at your body?
Yeah, I have.
Right. So you get that kind of a sensation and you sometimes might feel like you're talking to a higher power.
Cool. Is there any permanent brain damage with these hallucinogens which would cause you to continue to feel this way?
So hallucinogens in general, you know, long term, they haven't been studied enough for us to know one way or another if there's permanent damage. What I would suspect is just like a lot of things, if you take too much of it for too long, there's possibility of, you know, long-term brain damage. You know, marijuana technically is also a hallucinogen. because it can cause people to have an altered sense of reality as well. You know, it's not just that they're disinhibited, they get hungry and they're calmer, but some people also might think one arm is bigger than the other. So you can get similar features to the other substances as well. And they found that marijuana use long-term in someone who was using it, if not every day, several days a week for several years, might lead to an IQ drop of about 6 points long-term. So similarly, you know, I wonder if these other substances can do the same thing if used long-term for frequent periods of time. How much or how often, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that's something that we'll only start really figuring out as these substances are made legal and used in treatment and following up with someone 20 years down the line or 30 years down the line.
Mm-hmm. And for the legality, I know like medical marijuana is now approved in like a few states. Are hallucinogens, are they approved? And do you think they will get approved in the future if they're not?
So that's a great question. So when you think about marijuana, I think it's legal from a medical perspective in about 21 states. Recreational in about 21 states. So it's legal for recreational use. And then the other 19 states or so, it's for medical purposes. So a total of about 40 to 41 states out of 50 states in the United States have legal for either recreational and or medical use. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and Colorado was the first one in 2014. You have two countries, I think one is Uruguay and the other is Canada, that have it completely legal for recreational use. Okay. And that's been since 2017. So, you know, we're getting a wealth of data over the last 8 years or so. Mm-hmm. In terms of the hallucinogens, I know Oregon has decriminalized psilocybin. So they're allowing people to grow it themselves. And, you know, that is promoting the use of it in clinical trials. You know, we Cluster Busters, which is a nonprofit organization that advocates for cluster headache patients, was able to come up with a regimen that showed that it could be effective in cluster headache. And that's why it's being studied in the VA population at Yale. And it's an ongoing clinical trial. I think they just finished phase two and they're showing better benefit. So if these substances get studied more and, you know, there's medical evidence to suggest that it's useful, my thinking is that society will then catch up and allow it for it to be used, but probably regulated.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
But it's also dependent on the states that you're in. I suspect the West Coast and the East Coast might legalize it first. And then if there's demonstration of not just medical benefit, but economic benefit, then I think you'll get more of the, you know, the Midwest and all also embracing these mm-hmm. substances.
Yeah, but even if it's not legalized, I feel like many people still use it. Like it's nothing stopping them.
Sure. But, you know, you also have to think about it's not just at the state level, it's at the federal level. Mm-hmm. So, for example, marijuana is still a Schedule I substance, even though majority of the country is using it in some form, whether it be recreational and or medical. Mm-hmm. But marijuana does not have the same properties as something in Schedule I. And it was only placed there in the 1970s for political ideology, not because there was any evidence to suggest. So until it gets taken down at a federal level, it's still illegal.
Okay.
So that's something you have to think about too.
Mm-hmm. So my next question is something I hear about quite a lot. So pretend you have a patient who is taking Advil to treat headaches, but continues to take the Advil and feels that if they stop taking the Advil, their headaches get worse. How would you go about treating this?
That's a great question. So that's exactly what I was talking about earlier when I was saying medication overuse headache or rebound headache or medication adaptive headache. So that's the new term. What this means is any medication that is meant to be taken as needed. So we're saying Advil, ibuprofen, naproxen, naprosyn, Motrin, Aleve, aspirin, Excedrin, Tylenol, acetaminophen, or depending on your age group, you might be prescribed medications like triptans. So sumatriptan or elatriptan or nortriptan. If you use any of these medications more than 2 days a week combined together, your brain actually changes its structure at the molecular level. We would never see it on a CAT scan or an MRI, but that allows the pain signals to keep firing. So what people tend to notice is their headache never completely goes away. You know, either it's back within the same day, it's back the next day, or it doesn't even go away that day. And it's just that the pain reduced for a few hours or a few minutes, whatever it be. Right? This, in a way, I like to think of it as like a type of dependence.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you think, oh, I need this in order to treat my symptoms. What I tell patients is the only treatment for that is you have to stop it all.
Yeah.
Initially, for the first about 2 to 3 months, your brain, the pain signals are firing and there's nothing trying to stop the pain. So because there's nothing trying to stop the pain, people usually do feel worse. Mm-hmm. So I warn all my patients and I tell them, you will feel worse before you feel better.
Yeah.
But eventually, after about 2 months or so, your brain realizes you're not taking those medications and changes back to the way it used to be. And something about the headache gets better.
Does it actually take the full 2 months or is that just a estimate?
Great question. So it's dependent on the person. You know, there's no way I can guarantee, pretend you overuse Advil or Tylenol. There's no way I can guarantee, oh, it's going to take you 6 weeks before your brain changes, right? I have several patients where they stop it. Literally a week later, their headache is gone. I have some patients where it took them up to 3 months before they got better. You know, during that time, though, we obviously don't want someone to suffer as best we can. And, you know, we come up with different regimens, both preventive and abortive meaning to be taken as needed to try to help them with their pain. And we try to get them through the medication overuse headache phase or the medication adaptive headache phase.
Mm-hmm. Are there any preventive headache supplements you prescribe to your patients?
Oh, yeah. So there's several that are very effective. So magnesium is great. I typically recommend magnesium glycinate or oxalate. Magnesium citrate tends to cause more diarrhea, so I tend to hold off on using that. You can use riboflavin, which is known as vitamin B2. You can use coenzyme Q10, which I don't know if you're familiar with the cycle to make ATP. You've probably learned it in your grade 11 biology class. Yeah. And so coenzyme Q10 is one of those cofactors, so you can take that as well. There's a substance called butterbur, which comes from a German shrub, I believe. It's a good supplement to help, but it has a toxic compound in it called pyrrolizidine, which could damage the liver. So you have to make sure you get pyrrolizidine-free butterbur. There's even another supplement called Feverfew, though that one has the least evidence to suggest its benefits. So, you know, there are several supplements that are out there that can help. Some of my patients tell me about turmeric and how they think that it helps. You know, within the South Asian culture, turmeric is used in pretty much all foods. Now, then some of my patients tell me, oh, well, that's why South Asians don't have headache as much. I said, well, I also don't think it's as reported.
Yeah.
Right? So we don't know the truth. Turmeric has no conclusive evidence whether it actually helps or not. And, you know, it may actually lead to GI upset. So someone can get a lot of nausea, may get vomiting too if you take too much. So you have to be careful with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever I have a headache, my mom always dissolves the turmeric in water and gives it to me. And I don't think it really changes anything, but it makes her feel better. So,
yeah. And, you know, sometimes you got to treat your mom. Yeah. You're not treating yourself. You're treating your mom.
So along the lines of that, coming from a South Asian background, I am vegetarian. Mm-hmm. Do you think a vegan or vegetarian diet makes you more prone to headaches? And are there any like genetic causes for headaches or migraine?
Great question. And so, you know, what we found is, at least to date, North American cultures and Western European cultures tend to report headache disorders and migraine at a much higher rate than any of the South American cultures, the African cultures, or the Asian cultures. And what do the other cultures outside of Western European and North American cultures have in common? They tend to eat less meat. They tend to eat more fruits and vegetables. They tend to eat more seafood. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but at least for stroke prevention and heart disease prevention, they talk about how a Mediterranean diet is recommended the most. So a Mediterranean diet is heavy in seafood, fruits, and vegetables. Fish in general have good cholesterol, right? And so none of the bad cholesterol, or it does, but not to the same extent. So that's why fish tends to be recommended. You know, fruits and vegetables, as you're very well aware, are extremely good for you. So I always tell all my patients, eat your fruits and vegetables. And it's not just because they have tons of nutrition in them, but fruits and vegetables also have water. So when we talk about our daily water intake, it's not just how much you drink, but it's also what you eat. When you think about meat, red meat, which is beef, pork, deer, things like that, those are actually not good for you. They're the worst kinds of meat that you can eat. If you are going to eat meat, seafood tends to be the preferred, and, you know, chicken as well. We obviously recommend to our patients nothing fried because, you know, then that just takes away any health benefits from meat. Vegan and vegetarian diets in particular are super healthy, you know, but technically you have to think about it. Oreos are vegan. Does that mean I'm going to go tell you to eat Oreos? No. You know, it's the fruits, the vegetables, the salads, stir fries, things like that. that's where you'll really get benefit. What we found is a lot of these foods tend to decrease inflammation. So because they decrease inflammation, it's not just helpful for headache, but a lot of my patients who embrace more of a plant-based lifestyle, or at least eat more fruits and vegetables than they do meat, have noticed their joint pain gets better. If they have gout, their gout gets better. You know, they tend to have more energy. They don't need to rely on caffeine as much in order to stay awake. They even have some weight loss. And the reason for that is because you're eliminating unnecessary calories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's actually benefit in eating more of a plant-based diet as opposed to something detrimental or harmful to you. But what I would probably say is a Mediterranean diet is where we'll see the world going, which is more seafood combined with fruits and vegetables to have the best benefit for headache.
Yeah. I'm always told like my headaches are usually because I don't have enough protein like in my diet, and probably because I'm a picky eater, but do you think that's a cause for headache?
So a lack of protein is not shown to cause headache or be a trigger for headache. If anything, a lack of protein is shown to cause decreased energy, decreased metabolism, decreased pooping, as well as decreased muscle mass, right? So, and just because you're vegetarian or you're vegan, whichever you prefer, doesn't mean you don't get protein. You do get protein from vegetables, but you also get a lot of protein from nuts. I don't know if you knew this, but peanuts have more protein in them than a piece of steak does. So you can actually get way more protein from vegetarian sources than you would from actual meat sources. You know, when people think of a really big, juicy steak, they think, oh, they're eating all of it. Your body's really only absorbing 15 to 20% of it. So 80% of it is literally being pooped out of your body without any benefit at all. So, you know, I tell my patients who are thinking, oh, I only get protein from meat, I'm like, no, actually, you're pooping away most of your money that you've spent on that meat. In reality, put that money to vegetables. You'll end up getting more protein. Mm-hmm. So you get more bang for your buck. Yeah. So in your case, it's probably that you're a picky eater. You know, if you opened up your palate a little more, you ate more fruits and vegetables, as well as adding nuts into your diet, you'll get your protein sources.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Of course.
So the next section is a little myth or fact section. Again, growing up in a South Asian household, I always was told all of like these little things would cause a headache and for me not to do it. So the first one is sleeping with wet hair causes headache.
So, you know, my mom, I think, said that to my sister once, and then she learned not to say it again. wet hair does not actually cause headache. If anything, sleeping with wet hair just leads to damaged hair long term. Right? So it just damages your hair. That's really it. There's another theory where when you go to sleep, your body cools down to the temperature of the surrounding room. And as you know, at night, it tends to be cooler, right? And they always tell you sleep in a cooler environment if you have trouble sleeping. So when your head is cool, then you're preventing that cooling factor for the rest of your body to happen because your hair is wet and is trying to dry. And things that are trying to dry need heat, mm-hmm. right? So they think that that might affect your quality of sleep. So you do see that when you sleep with wet hair, right? The other thing is if you don't sleep with a proper pillow, then it can lead to neck pain because some people don't sleep with a pillow when they have wet hair. And when you sleep with wet hair, it actually leads to higher risk of like fungi and bacteria growing in your bed sheets. So it's probably just not recommended.
Okay. The next one, the location of your headache determines the cause. For example, a headache in like the front of your head is caused by caffeine.
Great question. There is no evidence to suggest that the type of headache is, and based on its location, can be identified through etiologies like caffeine. Okay. So for example, like, oh, stress is guaranteed only going to cause a headache here, or caffeine is only going to cause a headache here. What you actually see is the type of headache disorder that you have tend to have characteristic locations. Okay. So for example, migraine tends to be on the sides and across the front. Cluster headache tends to be around one eye, so either eye, but it tends to be around the eye. Cervicogenic headache tends to be from the neck, so cervical spine, right? So that's where cervical comes from. So it tends to be from the neck. Tension type headache, like I showed you earlier, tends to be a band around the head with a squeeze. That is where it comes from. Stress can be a trigger or contribute to any of the different headache types. It's location dependent on that person based on their headache disorder.
Mm-hmm. So the next one, you can sleep off a migraine because it only lasts a day.
So that's false.
Okay.
You know, what happens is when you have migraine, you're in pain. And what do people want to do when they're in pain? You want to rest, right? So when you rest, you're reducing the amount of oxygen demand and the metabolic demand on your brain. So you're allowing your brain time to heal. In some cases, some people's headache only lasts 2 hours. So they nap for the 2 hours and then their headache goes away, right? So they think, oh, I sleep and it gets better.
Yeah.
It's not that you slept and it got better. It's you slept because you were in pain, the headache got better, and then you felt better.
Okay.
Right? So you'll also find people have migraine. Sometimes the pain itself, part of the migraine, can last up to 3 days. Oh. Right? So, you know, even if people sleep, they'll tell you, I wake up the next day, the headache is still there. Exactly. So that's why it's variable depending on the person.
Okay. And the last one, a wrong prescription for glasses causes a headache.
It can.
Okay.
That is true. And the reason for that is because if you need glasses, first off, please wear them. Right? That's the first thing I tell all my patients. The second thing is, you know, if you wear glasses, but they're not the right prescription, then your eyes are straining to try to adjust to that prescription. And that much eye strain causes a lot of pain, which can then lead to headache.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for addressing those myths. I can't wait to tell my mom.
Oh, feel free to tell your mom. I don't know if she ever told you this, but my mom always kept telling me, if you drink something cold when you're sick, it's going to make it worse. There's no evidence to suggest that that's true. And then my mom also told me, don't eat a banana if you're sick because it'll lead to more coughing. There's no evidence to suggest that that is true either. My mom also told me, don't drink any Coke or Pepsi when you're sick because that causes you to be more sick. There's also no evidence for that.
Okay.
So feel free to enjoy your life.
Yeah, my mom says all of those.
Yeah, these are all common mom's tales. Mm-hmm. So then I get to tell my mom, no, mom, trust me, I'm a doctor.
Okay, so for the next question, a lot of the people I've talked to on my podcast have rare diseases, as I mentioned, and they often talk about how long it takes for them to get diagnosed, like over 10 years in some cases. Do you feel like in the recent years there's more like awareness going on of these neurological conditions, especially the rare ones? And do you think patients' diagnosis journeys are getting better?
I think that's a mixed bag.
Okay.
Right. One, it's dependent on who you see. If you see someone who's been practicing for 30, 40 years, right, it's not to say that they're not great doctors. They probably are, you know, they probably are keeping up to date. But in some cases, they get set in their ways, you know, they have their established practice, and what they know is what they know, and they may not be keeping as up to date with the knowledge base. So it can be harder there, but that's not to say that can happen with young doctors too, fresh out of fellowship or residency. Once they have their ways, they set it in their ways. So it can be variable depending on who you see.
Okay.
It can be dependent on where you go. You know, if you go to a big academic center, these rarer diseases tend to be more prominent. So it's more in their mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what I mean by that is, if you go to, I know, pretend for the sake of just throwing out a name, like Mayo Clinic or Harvard or one of these big name fancy institutions, what they may see more Friedreich's ataxia patients. Therefore, if you go there, the docs there might be more likely to think about it.
Okay.
Versus if you go to a place where it's really not that common or it doesn't exist, and then you have that disorder and you go to someone there, they may just not think of it right away. Right? But what you're seeing is a lot of younger doctors, at least from my own experience, who are used to Google and are comfortable with Googling, will Google symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not afraid to Google in front of a patient if I don't know what's going on. And I'll tell them openly, I don't know. Here, let's look it up. And the advantage there is I can show them what are reputable websites to look up and not just read, I don't know, I got this condition.com
mm-hmm.
or some fake website otherwise, right? So. Yeah. By doing that, I can come up with diagnoses. And if I think like, oh, actually, you know, it might fit with this condition, let's do the workup. So from my own experience, I've diagnosed a couple of rare diseases much sooner than, you know, may have been experienced by them at other doctor's offices. But that's not to say I haven't missed anything. I'm probably sure I've missed something that someone else may have diagnosed as well.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's also the country because a lot of countries in the East, they have like free healthcare, like Europe and Australia. So I guess people aren't more afraid to get a second opinion, and getting these second and third opinions might allow them to get diagnosed much faster than someone who in the United States is maybe scared to get a second opinion or can't afford to get one.
Yeah. And I would try to reword how you said it.
Okay.
It's not just countries in the East. It's even the countries in the North, my home country of Canada.
Oh.
It's universal healthcare, I think, is a more appropriate way to put it, because it's not really free. You pay through for it through your taxes.
Okay.
The only difference is you don't have to pay for supplemental health insurance. Employers might contribute that, but you don't always necessarily need it, or majority of the time you don't need it. And there's no co-pays when you go see a doctor. You know, medications tend to be more affordable, but that's because the governments have negotiated the prices as opposed to private insurance companies.
Okay.
And so I would rather word it as universal healthcare.
Okay.
But even within these countries, it can be hard to get in with a specialist. You know, just because you don't have to pay a copay, some specialists can take 6 months as a wait list to get into. And then I have American patients who will tell me, oh, that's why we don't want universal healthcare here. And I told them, how long did it take for you to get in with me? They said 6 months. I said, see, same time frame. The only difference is you had to pay to get in. They don't have to pay.
Oh.
Right? And people have this misconception that universal healthcare means, oh, you know, I'm not going to get the testing I need or anything. No, it's based on allocation of resources. If you're sick enough, you will get the care that you need very quickly.
Okay.
If you're not sick at all, you can wait. You know, it's that middle ground where you may be sick and, you know, there's still time that you may have to wait a little bit. And that's not fun. That's not ideal. But it's also due to a lack of MRIs and other resources mm-hmm. that are contributing to that.
Okay. I'll talk about it as universal healthcare from now on.
Exactly. You got it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So next, a lot of my viewers are high schoolers who are interested in pursuing medicine. What does your life look like as a board certified neurologist every day?
That's a great question. You know, it's variable depending on what you do. And what I mean by that, it's, you know, it can be different depending on the position you take. So there's neuro hospitalist positions. So these are neurologists that only do inpatient, meaning they're either a consult service where if someone's admitted under surgery or internal med, but the patient has some sort of neurologic condition that the primary team is concerned about, they can consult neurology. Neurology can go evaluate the patient, try to help them figure it out. There might be primary neurology services, for example, a stroke service, or just a general neurology service. For example, someone has MS, they got their meds, and now they have complications from it. They'll be admitted to the neurology service. So you can do inpatient neuro hospitals. That schedule tends to be 7 days on, 7 days off. So what I mean by that is Monday through Sunday, you're on, you're in the hospital, you're there all day. You know, you're taking care of your patients. The minute your work is done, you can go home. But you're on call overnight. So if anything happens or if there's new consults or anything, you can be called overnight for pretty much the whole week. And then when you're off, you're off. You have your full 7 days off.
Mm-hmm.
There are other positions similar to mine, which is a hybrid position. So I do mostly outpatient clinic. So for about 2 to 3 months at a time, Monday through Friday, 8 to 4 or so, I'm seeing patients in clinic. That can vary between 8 to 15, depending on the day and the types of patients that I'm seeing. And then I get my weekends off during that time. I get my evenings off. I get my nights off during that time. So I can make plans in the evenings. I can go have weekend trips. I can do all sorts of stuff. You know, like a standard 8 to 5 job.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm on call, then it becomes like the neuro hospitals. So for that Monday through Sunday, I'm on call. Once I get my work done, I go home. But I have to be available all night by phone call at least,
mm-hmm.
you know, to discuss patient care, to figure out what's going on.
Okay.
Then you have those who are fully outpatient. So they don't do any call whatsoever. So they're just Monday to Friday where they do clinic. And most often you'll get what we call a half day, which is meant to be administrative. So a lot of places will take it on our Friday afternoons. So if you don't have any paperwork to do, then you get your Friday afternoon off and it becomes a slightly extended weekend.
Mm-hmm. And on your days off, do you still need to research and do tasks for the hospital, or is it just your time?
That's your time.
Okay.
You know, now it's also dependent on the person. Some people bring their work home and that can affect your mental health long-term. You know, I always say my time is my time. You have to learn how to separate work and life, you know, from separate. I'm one of those individuals who works to live. I don't live to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I work so that I can have an income to support a life outside of work. You know, when I introduce myself, I don't introduce myself right off the bat as a doctor. I'll say I'm Aniket Nartekar, you know, I'm 5'4", you know, I'm this age. I love these sports teams like the Toronto Blue Jays or the Toronto Raptors. I love Marvel movies, et cetera, et cetera. And then when people ask me, what do? I don't say, oh, I work in a hospital or I work in healthcare. I try not to say doctor until the end because it's only a part of who I am. It's not my identity.
Yeah.
So I separate out that time. However, I will state, we do have what we call maintenance of certification exams after the initial board exam, if you pass, which is where every few years you'll have to do quizzes or you have to write your boards again. So we do have to stay updated with the knowledge. Things that can help. We get journal articles mailed to us. You know, they're typically magazines or newspapers, you know. So reading them from time to time does help. So maybe like one weekend a month, I'll sit down and just open up one and just start keeping up to date with the knowledge. You know, you do have to, but you're recommended to attend conferences. And depending on the employer that you have or the type of employment you have, you may have to go to at least one conference a year.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you go, okay, well, you're getting the latest updates at the conferences. So you can adapt that to your practice. You know, depending on where you are, if you're in an academic center, there's lectures going on regularly and you have to either be part of those lectures and or give lectures. So you're forced to stay updated. So we do it in different ways other than just taking our work home.
Okay. I like how you mentioned that you separate your work and your life. That's something I'm still trying to do. But other than separating your work and your personal life, how else do you prioritize your health and mental well-being?
Great question. So, you know, I remember being in your situation for me. Probably a few years ago. I'm not going to state how many years, but it's been a while. What I had to learn how to do was make time for things, right? So for example, for me, at least grade 9, grade 10, even grade 11, going out to play with my friends in my neighborhood was important, right? Going to play basketball or street hockey or whatever. So I would get my homework done and I would cap it. Okay, by 8 p.m., I have to get my homework done, especially in the summer. So I'd get my homework done, then go out until sunset. Then come back. Or I would go out to play for 1 or 2 hours and then come back and do my homework.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did when I was around your age, right? Or at least tried to as best I could. You know, obviously as I got older, grade 11, grade 12, and there was a lot more homework, a lot more intense, then I might reserve it for the weekends. But I still tried my best.
Mm-hmm.
In undergrad, you know, you tend to have a little more time. You know, obviously you're still busy, you're studying hard, but classes aren't as long. You can get breaks throughout the day, depending on how you arrange your schedule. And so it was prioritizing what you did in those breaks.
Okay.
For me, sometimes relaxing was sitting down and watching a TV show. So I prioritized, and it was literally in my calendar, watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, for example. All right, sit down and watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Or go to the gym or exercise or do what I need to, right? And then planning social events. So going into undergrad, being spontaneous was not as easy for me anymore. And just the way my life was, I could not be as spontaneous as some of the other individuals that I grew up with or that I know. So I would plan stuff. Okay, in 2 weeks, I'm going to go for dinner with these people or for lunch with this person or whatever. So I know I have something to look forward to. And you go for that. Being a doctor, it's very similar. You can't necessarily have spontaneous plans. So if you are interested in healthcare, understand this. You'll meet people who will say, oh, you know, I decided to go to Greece on Thursday. So I just bought a plane ticket. I'm tipped time off work and I'm going to go. I can't just do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one, I have too many student loans to be able to afford a ticket to Greece. Right? Then second of all, I can't just keep traveling the whole world because I don't get that kind of time off. And three, my job is not designed where I can just work remotely all the time and then hence travel. But the allotted vacation time that I do get, I make sure I do something,
mm-hmm.
whether that be go home to Toronto or find a new place to visit. Even if I can't afford to go internationally, can I afford to go somewhere in the country? And even if I can't afford to do that, is there an area in the place that I'm in that I have not visited before that might be worth visiting?
Mm-hmm.
And doing that. And then carving out times in your day to do certain things, right? So I make it a priority that 3 to 4 days a week, I hit the gym and I'll do weights. You know, I just bought a bicycle. So I'm planning on commuting to work at least 2 days a week while it's warm. So if I can do that, that's a way to get my exercise in, but it's exercise towards purpose.
Yeah.
I've just never been a fan of running. I don't understand it. I've never gotten the runner's high and my knees just kill me. So I don't believe in running, but people enjoy it, obviously. But I believe in biking because I like biking. So, you know, do what makes you happy. And the other thing I always tell people is don't forget who you were. So, you know, as you get older and as things get more stressful and, you know, more busy, you're going to realize that your time is more valuable and is more precious. But what I always tell people is don't forget what made you you, right? Don't forget what made you happy. So if there was something that makes you happy, prioritize that as well. So for me, for example, I'm a huge Marvel nerd. So I make sure every Marvel movie that came out, I went opening weekend. I watched them all. If I didn't catch them on TV, I waited until they were on streaming. Right. So, hey, I still make sure that I prioritize that aspect of my life.
Mm-hmm. I love Marvel too. I always go to the movies like 2 days after they come out.
Exactly. And, you know, I grew up reading the comic books. So I read thousands of comic books, actually. So what's nice for me is when I see the movies, like, oh, I kind of remember that storyline, or I remember the storyline, or this is completely new. And I like the way the director and the writers take on that same character.
Mm-hmm. And for my last question, what is the best thing a person can do to prevent a headache? And is it sometimes just out of your control?
Great question. If someone has a headache disorder, for example, migraine, cluster headache, etc., it's a disease process. And because it's a disease process, there's no way that you can 100% prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? At some point, it's going to rear its ugly head and people are going to have a lot of pain and a lot of suffering from it. Things that you can do to try to prevent them from happening as often. One, living a healthier lifestyle. Studies have shown regular exercise can reduce the amount of headache days that you have, the intensity of the headache, or how long the headache lasts, up to 50%. So, you know, we prioritize exercise, particularly yoga. Yoga is the one exercise that's actually been proven to help with headache. You know, healthier eating habits. As you and I discussed earlier, you know, red meat is pro-inflammatory. It's actually known to trigger headache, depending on the individual. It's not 100% guaranteed. But it's dependent on the individual. So going more towards a Mediterranean, vegetarian, vegan diet is shown to be beneficial. Weight gain is not a cause for headache, but it contributes to headache disorders. So encouraging weight loss habits, whatever that be. Now, you know, this is with the understanding that in some people, no matter how hard they try, no matter how healthy they eat, work out, do all those things, they may not lose the weight as easily as someone else. Right. So, but seeing if there are any factors involved that you haven't addressed that could be addressed. For example, even though they say they're eating healthy, we don't necessarily have time as doctors to go through every single food they eat. But maybe they can meet with a dietitian. Right. Maybe it's the way they're cooking it. We don't know. Right. There are so many things that are involved when it comes to weight loss. It's not an easy journey. But working with your patients in an interdisciplinary approach to try to get them the best result possible, that can help. Encouraging even something as much as walking. Walking is a great form of exercise that not enough people do. You know, so I tell my patients, park at the end of the parking lot before going into the store and walk in. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're only on the second floor of an office building, why do you take the elevator? Go take the stairs. You know, my general rule of thumb is if you're three floors or below, take the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I'm grounding in the hospital and I'm only going within three floors, I'll take the stairs all day. Right? Like one of my former mentees, who's a good friend of mine now, she messaged me how she walked 41 flights of stairs because she decided to take the stairs, just all while rounding in the hospital as an intern. Right? So, you know, it happens. You can do it, and you can get exercise in different ways. Then, you know, other things that you can do. Obviously, we recommend don't drink alcohol in excess. Drink in moderation. If you know alcohol is a trigger for you, maybe don't drink it. Right? If you know certain substances are triggers for headache, for example, cocaine or crystal meth or whatever, you know, and obviously addiction is a disease. It's super complicated and I'm not in any way trying to minimize it. But if you have access to those resources that can help you with quitting, work on quitting. Smoking is a very well-known trigger for headache. Work on quitting smoking, right? There are so many lifestyle things that we can do that can, if not completely prevent headache, at least reduce how often it is occurring, the intensity, and how long it lasts. There, and this is where I think not enough doctors and APPs, which are called advanced practice providers, so physician assistants and nurse practitioners, I don't think we as a medical community emphasize that enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then just knowing how certain nutritionist factors contribute to headache, right? Kind of like what you were describing. You felt like you were low in protein. But as you and I discovered, it's probably because you're a picky eater as opposed to what options you have to eat being a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So realizing that aspect will really make a huge difference.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for being on my podcast. I'm definitely going to make a lot of changes in my lifestyle after talking to you. Definitely going to eat more nuts. My mom's been trying to get me to eat more, so I will try it now.
Yeah.
And also headache has been like a thing. It's always been around me. My mom gets headaches a lot, and I've never really understood what was happening. But after you talked about all of these substances that contribute to headache and also the lifestyle choices we make that may cause headache, it really demystified headache for me. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. And one last thing before you forget, or before I forget, I should say, mm-hmm. is people tend to say the term migraines or headaches, right? When you say the plural form of those words, you make them sound like they're isolated episodes. But remember, as we talked about, migraine is a disease process. So because it's a disease, you don't go, I have hypertensions when your blood pressure is up. Yeah. Or I have depressions when you have a depressive episode. So similarly, I educate all my patients, and I'll do for you as well and your audience. Try to not say migraines or headaches. Say migraine. Say headache. Choose a second word to pluralize. You know, something like attacks, episodes, or days. So I tell my patients, tell me how many migraine days you've had, migraine attacks, migraine episodes, or headache days, headache attacks, headache episodes. And by them doing that, they better advocate for themselves. People will take them more seriously. Mm-hmm. And one last thing, people tend to think that migraine is just the most severe headache, and that the mild and moderate headache, meaning milder pain or moderate pain, you know, somewhere between 5 to 7 out of 10 instead of 8 out of 10 in intensity. They think like, oh, that's just a regular headache, and then the migraine is just the most severe. I tell them, there's no such thing as a regular headache. Again, majority of the world doesn't get a headache in a pattern of any kind. Right. So as a result of that, even the mild and moderate headache is part of the migraine spectrum. It's part of that disease process, or whatever disease they suffer from or that they have is part of that disease process. It's just that the intensity can fluctuate. Okay. And as the intensity gets higher, new symptoms come, or the symptoms they had get worse. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's important to think of it that way. And that's why I separate it out as mild, moderate, and severe headache episodes. Okay. What I will say is, for classification purposes, yes, we do say the most severe headache with certain features might be migraine as opposed to non-migraine headache. But we as headache specialists don't say, oh, that's a regular headache.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And make sure you educate your mom on not saying migraines and say that she used to say migraine attacks.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. One last thing, if you're okay with it. Yeah. There's a great nonprofit organization. It's called Not Miles for Migraine.
Okay.
So
I'll link it.
You should look it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look it up. It's a great website. It promotes education for patients and the public. And there's always great ways to volunteer.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Of course.